that the word unprecedented, I mean, I think that was so overplayed, at the start of the pandemic. And for me, that was really irritating because it wasn't unprecedented when we talk about markets. It wasn't unprecedented for investors in general. Whether you're in South Africa, global, anywhere, the unexpected is part of life.
Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and this week I'm very excited to have on Warren Ingram. He is an award-winning financial planner, and you may have heard him on Bruce Whitfield's business show. He's also written two excellent books on personal finance and has just launched his third book, Global Investing Made Easy. And so welcome, Warren.
Thanks so much, Maya. It's wonderful to be on the show.
And you know what, Warren? You and I were just chatting. We crossed paths. We've worked it out. 1999, last century, when I was working at BGM and I was leaving and you were arriving. So that's been a long time. I mean, you start to realize how much time has passed. I went off to have my son, who's now 21. So yeah, those years at BGM were part of the foundation of where you are now.
Yeah, and actually amazing that we're talking about a global investing book. And I mean, that was the core of what you and we were doing at the time, right? Was finding new ways to invest for investors. And a lot of the time in global investments was quite new for all of us. And 21 years later, here we are.
You're right, actually, because I joined BGM to start the offshore investing because it was July 1990. Six, I think it was, or that the exchange controls fell. And we were allowed to take the sum total, I think, of 200,000 Rand offshore. And, you know, people wanted to know how to invest offshore. And I look now at how much easier it is. And I think that's what we're going to be chatting about today. But I was really, really thrilled that when I saw your book, when it came out, because this is something that so many, and this is, by the way, oh, I know with this virtual background, it makes it a little bit odd, but this is what I'm trying to find it where, there we go. It comes out.
There we go.
This is Global Investing Made Easy. It's a topic that so many of my followers and readers are becoming more and more interested in. But I wanted to start off, I loved your introduction, Warren, and I just want to read this to the listeners. In your preface, you write, the first major challenge was about the pandemic, obviously this is about the COVID pandemic. The first major challenge was to realize that no one had a realistic idea of how the pandemic would affect us in the short term, nor did anyone know what would happen in the long term. As soon as I realized this, I was back on familiar ground, because I understood that we were in the middle of an unpredicted event that would cause human beings to react in a predictable fashion. And amen to that when you've been in the markets as long as you have and I have. But maybe just expand on that. What is the predictable fashion that we all do in a crisis?
So I think we all arrive, you know, and we're normally, you know, just investing and carrying on with our lives. And then something hits us, you know, usually 4 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon and you know, it completely rattles our foundations as investors, as people, you know, as economies, as businesses, all of those things. And then we immediately panic, which is, I guess, understandable. And we kind of start to read, I think, I can't remember what year it was, but the word unprecedented, I mean, I think that was so overplayed, at the start of the pandemic. And for me, that was really irritating because it wasn't unprecedented when we talk about markets. It wasn't unprecedented for investors in general. Whether you're in South Africa, global, anywhere, the unexpected is part of life. And so... we then, the moment we realize that and we say, okay, so here's an event, it's hit us. Why we got hit and what hit us is almost irrelevant to understanding how we're going to act. And then we start to act as we do as human beings. And so now we go from the realm of markets, technology, viruses, et cetera, to straight human psychology, but more to the point of big herd behavior. So understanding that markets they're often not the most rational, intelligent things. If you had to classify it, to me, it always reminds me of kind of a very large herd of very unintelligent cows. You know, they kind of just react. And at some point, when individual, you know, people and investors stop and actually start to think, then you can say logic kicks in. But in the beginning, we panic. We all run in a direction as a collective. And I'm saying not humans now, but actually the whole of us as markets. And we run. And where we run is right off the cliff. We sell everything. You know, we sell in panic. We immediately, you know, the kind of phrase risk off becomes something. You know, we just say worldwide, you know, let's not look at value or valuations or anything. Let's just go to a place of safety. And that usually means sell shares, you know, sell if you're an American, you sell basically everything that's not American. And, you know, you bring all your money back to America, you put all your money in cash. And in the South African context, sell shares, go to cash and just sit and wait and wait for things to get better. And I mean, you know, nearly whatever it is, 550 days later, things are, you can argue, are not better, but look at what markets have done. So what happens is we react, we panic, we stop panicking usually because we can't sell anything else. So that's, you know, as a collective, and then the rational people start to react a bit more quickly. They start to look around and they say, well, hang on. You know, there is this company, this share, this property, whatever it is, that's actually offering extraordinary value. And why would I want to sell this? In fact, let me buy it from the rest of the people that are panicking. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we start to see this behavior of, you know, irrational fear, then kind of a period of consolidation. Then the early buyers start to buy, the market start to pick up momentum. And then those that have been waiting for things to get better start to say, well, hang on, the world's not better. You know, the economy's not better, but I'm missing out. So I'm going to jump back in again because I'm missing out. And of course, they're missing out usually just before things turn over again.
And, you know, I mean, that is the cycle of fear and greed. And we saw it. I mean, I was sitting in the markets at the end of the 90s, then we had the 1998 emerging market crisis. We saw exactly the same behavior. Then we saw the dot-com bubble. You know, we live through these cycles over and over again, and we see that the pattern repeated. And what was interesting to me with specifically actually with the COVID crash in March was how quick it was. It fell quickly, but it bounced back quite quickly as well. So you literally missed those bounce back trading days, you know, that massive return that people actually got from the market that year, you actually just couldn't have caught it up again because it just bounced so quickly. And I think that's it. You cannot, you know, I always used to say, Warren, when we had clients who would get it right, who'd make a call right of exiting the market before a crash, was the worst thing that could ever happen because they'd spend the rest of their lives market timing and losing money.
I remember a few years ago, I was sitting in the middle of America in a tiny little place called Omaha, listening to the sage of Omaha, Warren Buffett, and a youngster kind of stood up in the back and put up his hand at question time and said, you know, my financial advisor had sold all my investments just before the financial crash in, you know, the 2007-2008 financial crisis. He bought in again, you know, in the beginning of 2009. And you know, this was then a good few years after that. And my advisor is now telling me I need to sell again. What should I do? And Warren Buffett said, what you should do is fire your advisor because he's been coin tossing with your money. And it's happened to have landed on heads twice when he's called heads. And you don't know that he's going to flip the coin and call the direction of that coin again correctly. And it's time to get out. Mm. Get out of your advisor, not get out of the markets. And I think you're right. I mean, market timing, you know, it's such a nice, intuitive, simple thing to understand around a dinner table, around the braai. But in the real world, you know, we've seen so many studies showing that it's just not a possibility.
And I think even if you get it right, exiting the market, getting back in, the timing of getting back in is, you know, like we said, it usually is still is rallying when the fear is still quite high. So it's very unlikely people have, you know, get that right. But I want to also move on to your book where you speak about, and I think it's quite early on your book, you start with a question of what is your dream? Why is it important to have a vision before you make investment decisions? And I mean, I agree with you on this, but maybe just unpack, like, what does that vision mean? And why is that relevant when it comes to making these decisions?
So the thing about money is it's very closely related to our behaviors, just around anything. Yeah? And so, you know, money becomes either an expression of our behavior or we use it to, you know, as a crutch or something. And so when we're sitting with a situation where we can say, well, I can buy this now and it will give me joy or pleasure or whatever the deal is now, or I cannot and have something much later in life that will give me lots of pleasure over many, you know, many years. That's not really good for us as human beings. We don't, as a rule, we don't like to kind of delay our gratification. You know, we want instant gratification. We want the car, the house, the cappuccino, the holiday, whatever it is. We want it all now. And so when you're sitting in a position where you have to make a trade-off, and it can be a very small trade-off. I'm not going to buy the extra, you know, cappuccino now. I'm going to make it at home. Or, you know, I'm not going to buy the car because it's a huge waste of money, you know, and I'm going to, you know, kind of keep driving my car until it falls apart so that I can reach financial independence. Those are long-term goals, and it's very hard for us to think about ourselves in the future. So the only way I can do it and I can think of is you've got to have something that really motivates you, really excites you whenever you think about it. So that when you say, okay, I need to make a trade-off now, the vision I have for myself is I want to be somewhere. I want to go on holiday. I want to sit in, on the coast looking at the sea or whatever the deal is. And that thing, that goal, that vision motivates me so much that actually sacrificing the cappuccino now is just not an issue for me. It's not a sacrifice. It's saying I'm taking another little step towards my goal. Rather than saying to people, look, you know, just save for retirement. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. It's not real for us. And I think we see it, for, you know, for example, the big medical aids and, you know, a lot of the tech companies, they kind of gamify our behavior. They give us lots of little goals all the time to make us work to these things. And I would say use, you know, their rather cynical behavior and just steal the good idea, which is gamify yourself, you know, set goals that are, you know, 1 month, 1 year, 10 years and 20 years away. And then say, okay, great. If I reach my 1 year goal, I can do whatever it is that, you know, the wasteful thing. So it's great. I'm not saying we need to live like, you know, hermits on a hill and never spend money and have no life, but give yourself a vision that really motivates you so that you work towards that and then have life during that. You know, I think the mistake also would be to say that you can't have any fun and you can't do anything until you reach 65. And then sadly you die of a heart attack at 66. I mean, that's no way to live. So I think it's about just getting that balance, and the vision is the balance.
You know, you're talking about having fun whilst you're still earning and living. A family friend of mine told me, she's 70 now, but she told me that for her 50th birthday, She started investing. She took out a policy, you know, 5-year endowment or whatever it was in those days, specifically for her 50th birthday. And when the time came, it was a 5-year investment. The time came, she had this lump sum and she had called it my 50th birthday. And she took her whole family overseas for a big celebration and a big holiday. And her advisor said, are you doing the right thing? You know, this is a lot of money. And she said, this is what the money was for. That's why I put it there. So I think we also need to do those things. You know, we need to have all these multiple goals. We need to have the shorter term goals where we actually get to enjoy our life. So I think, yeah, very, very important. And I listened to that and I thought, I like that. I think I'm going to start having my my little investments for every 10 years. I'm going to do something like really amazing. I just thought that was really, really clever. Now, in the book, Warren, you talk about your dreams and you say, they don't have to be grand dreams. They can be quite modest. And you said yours are modest. Your vision is modest. So what is your vision for your life?
It's like a confession time. So for me, I mean, a few things. One, my wife and I don't have kids, but we have a charity. And it's kind of an important thing for us, you know. So the books that I write, I don't pocket the money. You know, the money goes to that charity, and it's, we put kids through school and university, and for me that's very motivating. So to continue that is important for me. I think there'll come a time where I can't put a date on it because it'll upset my staff. But there'll come a time where I'll stop working, you know, day to day, and focus on building out that charity. And that's something that I'd like to do. It gives me purpose. And I think that's important. You know, I'd like to have a second career, which is in that field, and it drives me a lot. And then I like being in space. I like being in open places with a small community. So, I mean, as we were chatting about off air, I'm sitting in the middle of the Karoo at the moment in a beautiful little town, and I love the sense of community that you get from a small town, and kind of, you know, having deeper connections with people, and that will be something I want to do. And then I'd like to be in a place with lots of sunshine, and I'm looking out the window now, and lots of clear and clean air. And then my big financial weakness in life is I absolutely love to travel. So, I mean, that's a core in our financial planning is almost, you know, it doesn't quite take priority over medical aid. That would be wrong, but travel is right up at the top of our goals, mine and my wife. So we spend a lot of our time planning holidays, whether it's in the bush in South Africa or, on the beach, in as many islands as we can. So I've got a book called 501 Islands to See Before You Die. And I'm going to give it my best go to see how many of them I can get through.
Yeah, working your way through the book. That's a brilliant idea. And well, you certainly, the Karoo would meets many of those ticks many of those boxes. And I think, Warren, you know, travel is important. I think it's one of the ones that's important for a lot of people, certainly for me as well. In fact, on the 26th of March, 2020, I was supposed to be celebrating my 25th wedding anniversary in Japan with the cherry blossoms. So I haven't got there yet. I'm still sitting here and it's very frustrating. But I suppose the one upside of not being able to travel is that we've been able to save more money towards more travel one day in the future. So that is, I think that's important. And also one of the things with travel is that you also want to travel when you still have your health and your youth. You know, again, you know, postponing it and saying, well, I'm going to wait until I'm much older. And I actually had a very wise woman said to me, she said, Maya, do it whilst you still want to do it. So she's in her early, late 60s, early 70s. And she said, I've got the money now. She sold her business. She's made a lot of money in her lifetime. And she said, but I just don't actually feel like it anymore. She's got her health. It's not that, but I just don't feel like traveling as much. And I regret that I didn't do more of it when I still had the energy and desire to do so. So I think life is about finding those balances. But getting back now to the offshore the investment part. What I really liked in your book was how you positioned the offshore argument, not about politics, not about the rand, not about, you know, it becomes either it's an anti-South Africa or patriotic argument. It's not. And I'm going to quote two lines from the book. You write, investing our money in many different countries and industries means we can benefit from unexpected growth and reduce the impact of unexpected losses on our investment. So it's about diversification. And it's about opportunities. You also write, investing far from home to ensure we take advantage of opportunities not available to us in our home country. This is it. I mean, what is your philosophy about making that decision to invest offshore?
So I think you were attached to some of the Twitter storm that followed your photo that you sent of my book, where I got abuse because I'm one of the people that's been saying for a long time that, you know, there are some talking heads out there that have a huge agenda, which is to drive their product, drive their business, their view. And so they sell overseas investments as an anti. In other words, it's an anti South Africa. It's a getaway.
No names mentioned, Warren. Are we going to? Yeah. I've also had I've had blow ups with certain individuals, like big blow ups as well. So yeah.
So for me, the question comes, as you say. I mean, you're getting that. I get it all the time, which is people saying, you know, we want to look at this global investing more seriously, but what is the right way to do it, and when should we be doing it, etc. And so for me, you know, the critical thing here is to say that there needs to be a structure to how you invest, and whether it's in South Africa or overseas or anywhere in the world, it's starting with first principles. What are the things that are relevant to you? And then how do you go? And so, hitting the microphone. And so if we talk about global investing, that's a starting point, just to say, it's not about running away from your home country or running away from South Africa or running away from a political situation. It's about saying it doesn't make sense. If you were sitting, if there was really a man on the moon and he was looking at the world, he wouldn't say, okay, I'm going to allocate all of the capital that I've built up on the moon to South Africa and I'm going to put it all there. It just doesn't make sense. Similarly, if he decided to put money in America, and because that's where he wanted to settle, he wouldn't put all his money in America. It makes sense that you've got to have those exposures to geographies that you don't have. That's sometimes as basic as climate. The climate is a huge issue in terms of agriculture and those kinds of things. Then you look at education. We don't have the universities that promote science and technology the way that other countries do. And you keep going on this kind of chain of excellence in certain areas that aren't available in others. And so to me, it's about saying, okay, I do want to take advantage of opportunities in other countries. And that gives me the unexpected growth when, for example, if we go back to South Korea, it goes from being an economic backwater to suddenly an Asian miracle, one of the Asian tigers. And so to participate in that with their hugely productive population that, very focused on technology and the like, is it's an attractive place to be. And I don't need to get on a plane and relocate myself to go and take advantage of it. I can simply invest in their market. The same with America. We just don't know, for example, what the next big, emerging countries will be necessarily. So I think it's about taking advantage of opportunities. And then at the same time, looking at your home country and saying, well, okay, in South Africa, we've got tourism, we've got some agriculture, we've got mining. Really, that's what we've got. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have big pharmaceutical businesses. We don't really have, big tech businesses, et cetera. So yes, I want to invest in the things that are specific and unique to my home country, but I really want to have things that are totally unrelated to mining, for example, that will benefit when mining is going down. So it is really about proper diversification to reduce risk in bad times, wherever that may be, and then taking advantage of good opportunities in the good times as well. And then globally, what will happen is some of your money will be doing well some of the time, other parts of your money won't be doing well. And that's the very point of diversification. Not everything goes up all the time.
And, I've got my little spreadsheet of all my investments. I'm diversified, well diversified across both, because my retirement funds, of course, are quite locked in here in South Africa, both my husband and mine. So we have most of our discretionary funds offshore. And I tell you, the years where my offshore adds value and the years that it's unbelievable how often countercyclical it can be, and how one gets a boost from one more than the other. And you just realize it makes the ride a little smoother, at least every year. There's usually something giving me a little bit of a boost there. And I suppose, well, that's diversification, isn't it? But now what I also want to talk about for a lot of people. So yes, we all get the argument you should have offshore in your portfolio for all the right reasons, not because you're a naysayer, but what products are out there? And this is the question I get the most, how do I actually do it? And Warren, you and I are talking about when joining BJM, there was very little options, now you can have local offshore, and you can have proper foreign investments offshore. So maybe just unpack that for our listeners.
So I always think it relates a little bit about to the amount that you want to invest. So if you're someone that's saying, I've got a few thousand rand a month or a few hundred rand a month, doesn't really matter, but a few thousand rand a month to invest on a debit order, and I'd like to start building up my global exposure, that's great. I think then, unfortunately, the product providers have these terrible names. So looking at something called a feeder fund, makes a lot of sense. And just, just briefly, that means, although it's a rand-denominated investment, when you put your money in there, that rand-denominated investment then sends all of the money overseas and goes and buys a pure global investment. So it will benefit from that market rising or falling in, let's just say, dollars as an example, plus the exchange rate of whatever the rand is doing against the dollar. So when you get your money back one day, yes, it will come back to you in rands, but all of the exposure that you've had has been to global markets. So I think for debit order money, to me, a feeder fund makes a lot of sense, simply because you're not paying the banks to convert your rands into dollars and paying the huge commissions that they're charging you. And then the delays on transactions of actually getting the money overseas and getting going. So to me, I think when your amounts are below, let's say around 500,000 rand, and you're looking to do debit orders or small lump sums, then feeder funds make a lot of sense. And just on that, you know, I always think, don't try and predict what markets are going to be the best in, you know, globally. So don't go and say, well, I'm going to put all my money in China or all my money in Japan or all my money in America. I would just have a really solid global diversified, you know, investment, you know, that invests in all the markets all the time. And, you know, it could be as simple as a world index. You know, you don't need to be a market expert to do that.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, Warren, is also, I mean, you can do your ETFs. We'll talk about that a little bit later, maybe. You can do your ETFs, unit trusts, because people always say, oh, where do I find these feeder funds? But, you know, all unit trust companies have one. Exchange-traded funds, there's feeder ones. But I think I agree with you, just having a well-diversified one. And I must say, just looking at the Chinese market in the last few weeks, keep diversified. Only diversified.
Yeah, and diversification is going to help you so many times that, and, you know, that you just wouldn't predict. Yeah. And then I think when you're investing larger amounts, so now we're over the 500,000 rand and more, then I think it makes sense to actually convert your rands into a global currency, send the money out, and then invest in a properly globally diversified investment. And so, you know, to your point, what should that be? It can be really simple. For example, you can go and buy a global equity unit trust. So in other words, a unit trust that invests in all the stock markets in the world. And as we just mentioned, that could be something that where you're paying a fund manager to choose the individual shares across the world, or you could buy an index tracking unit trust. And you could really do it as simply as that. The other alternative is open a stockbroking account overseas and then buy the exchange traded fund that you mentioned. You know, you can buy one. And, you know, the name of those is usually the MSCI World Index, if you want to know. And you just buy that and you've got exposure to the world's biggest markets in one thing. The only caution I would say with investing globally is just make sure that the home of the money is in the right place. In other words, they talk about the domicile or the jurisdiction, which is just the home of the money. And a lot of the time, we get so much news from America that we fixate on America as South Africans as a home for our money. And the problem there is just that, you know, the Americans, they love to tax. And one of the things they really do is they like to tax foreigners who invest in America. So if you've got more than $60,000 invested in America and you pass away, the American government's going to take 40% of that money for the pleasure of you leaving your money there. So you have to choose a jurisdiction that doesn't tax you twice. In other words, you know, look at places like Ireland, the country Ireland, you know, the Channel Islands, Luxembourg, Switzerland. Those are all great jurisdictions because they're highly regulated, lots of fraud protection, all of those things, but they also don't tax the, you know, non-residents. And I think that the home of your money is almost as important as everything else that you do.
But I also find, you know, there's so many South African providers who do offshore, proper offshore. So, and which I think is often easier because you don't have to, you know, your client, you know, the sort of FICA rules, you know, the anti-money laundering rules, they kind of can comply with all of them. You pick up the phone to somebody in London and you say, hi, I'm from South Africa. They say, sorry, we're not interested because we don't know who you are. So I find generally, you know, all the big fund managers here have, and they domicile generally Guernsey, Jersey, you know, the right sort of countries in terms of tax. And then, of course, you've got many platforms, many of the stockbrokers in South Africa offer proper offshore portfolios. You can actually, you know, open offshore accounts with them. So, I mean, your view on that, I just think it keeps life simpler also from a tax perspective because they report, based on our tax requirements.
Yeah, you're right. So that's the one big thing is, you know, these global platforms, I mean, they wouldn't know the South African financial year, you know, at all, and they just don't care. Mm-hmm. And so tax reporting and FICA and FASE and all of those things, you know, a lot of that's taken care of by the South African product providers, which is great. I have no doubt and no concern in my mind. A lot of the time, people are quite concerned about, you know, the prospect of a change in government. And then all of a sudden there's this whole pressure on the South African institutions who have foreign funds to bring money back. It's not a big issue for me. I think it's, you know, but I guess that would be the only real concern for someone saying, I don't want to attach to a South African institution. But beyond that, as you say, I mean, the convenience and the tax reporting makes life so much better.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And just whilst we're on that topic, you know, if you have offshore investments, should you have a separate offshore will? Should it be included in it? Or should you use something like a life wrapper, which kind of protects the assets, as an endowment. I mean, what is your kind of advice that you give to clients?
So let's hit the will first. I think if you're in the right jurisdiction, so back to those Channel Islands or Ireland or Luxembourg or Switzerland, they will recognize the South African will and they will recognize the South African letters of executorship. In which case, all you need to do is make sure that your South African will is very clear about what you want to do with your money. And you know, as long as there's enough money in South Africa to pay the taxes and the fees of winding up your estate, then there is no need to bring the money back. But you have to just be clear that your will covers those things correctly. So if you're in a place like mainland UK, the city of London, or in America, or Germany or something like that, I think it makes sense to then get a will in those jurisdictions, make sure that they're covered. And then especially in countries where you've got Sharia law, so for example, in Dubai or Malaysia or Indonesia, or one of those where just the laws are quite different. I think it's critical that you make sure that you've got a will that sets out exactly what you want to happen with the money. Because if you don't do that, you could be kind of subject to some pretty bad adverse consequences for your family. Mm. So life wrappers and the like, I'm pretty stingy with paying fees to product providers, Maya. So it always starts for me on, what are they going to charge? What are they going to charge me for me to invest my money there, and what benefits are they going to give me? So I think, life wrappers, and just simply, a life wrapper for people who don't know, it's kind of an endowment really that, in South African law, packages all your investments inside and then you don't really pay too much tax while you're alive, while the investment's going, but you do pay tax, when you take it out again. But for me, often they're missold because they are expensive. They can be expensive. I shouldn't say they all are, but they can be expensive. And then the benefits aren't as good as one thinks. So if you ask me, I tend to, I'm a simple guy and I like simple things. So I tend to try and keep things very simple, very clear, very transparent. So I prefer exchange traded funds, shares, mutual funds, but for large amounts of money, definitely, I think structures make some sense. And structures, for example, could be, something like eventually a family trust overseas. But you're talking about very large amounts of money where the costs of running the trust become much more tolerable. But there's a huge amount of tax planning that has to go into that. And on the other side, making sure that you choose the right company, et cetera. So I would say get a lot of advice. On the life plans, I haven't done a lot of them. I always feel uncomfortable with the costs. I don't know that the benefits are there. I know the product providers will be very upset with me and they'll be writing you lots of long emails after this, Maya. I'm sorry, but I'm not a big fan. I think they might have a role to play, but not as often as everyone thinks.
Well, they've really written lots of letters to me because I did the maths and I worked out that, even if you are a 45% taxpayer on 45% tax rate, remember an endowment is already taxed at 28% at the company tax rate. So for you to, that tax benefit to you, if you're paying more than 0.25% a year for the structure, you're better off paying the tax. So they have to come in at a really low cost. And obviously there is the thing that it ring fences it from executive fees because it goes to your beneficiaries, stays out of your estate. So there's a little bit of estate planning stuff there. But I think, we as South Africans are so desperate not to pay tax that we often overpay on fees to avoid paying tax. And we're actually probably better off, in all fairness, paying the tax. At least it's possibly doing some good for the country as opposed to just boosting the pockets of our financial institutions. So that would be my... So there we go, Warren. We're going to make sure we're getting lots of calls now from product providers. And I thought just to end off, you said you're a simple man. You like simple things. And in your book, you do talk about your own portfolio. So maybe just give everybody an idea of how you do it in terms of what you use, passive, active, index trackers.
Yeah, so I must say I am a believer in index tracking investments. So in the South African context, just tracking the top 40 or top 50 shares in South Africa or in the world, that world index that I've mentioned already. I think the low cost of index tracking investments is so compelling. That argument is so compelling now that it's very hard to just ignore it, on principle. Having said that, I do think that the world is changing quite a lot around stock market. Well, the stock market world is changing quite a lot. In other words, we're seeing less and less companies being listed on stock exchanges. There are more and more companies that are just finding it far too expensive, far too cumbersome to be a listed company. And so you're finding some brilliant, high quality, you know, really good businesses that are just staying private for you know, almost their entire lives. And so to me, I think the combination of choosing, you know, a good global index for half of my money makes all the sense, on the basis that I don't know which country is going to be better, whether it's America or, you know, anywhere else. I'm just going to be in the index and enjoy, hopefully enjoy the value of markets over time. I nearly said the ride, but it's not a game. It's more important than that. But then the other half of the money, I do choose investment companies, and those are, we're not familiar with them in South Africa, but just in general, companies that are listed on a stock exchange, and their sole purpose is to buy investments in businesses. And the advantage of those is that a lot of them are buying companies that are just not listed. So a lot of the earliest investors, you know, 10 years ago, for example, you know, in Tesla, were investment companies, because they could take money, allocate significant pools of money to, you know, to an unlisted business run by, you know, potentially a madman who was going to change the way that we drive cars and store our energy, etc. And they could do it in that space. So I like investment companies for half of my money. And it's not about pure growth there. I think it's about saying that I think if you choose good people who pick shares or pick companies, they can often manage the risk of the index. You know, it's inherent in stock markets that, you know, the biggest companies might also be the most expensive. It just happens like that. You know, I think you mentioned off air, you know, in South Africa, you've got that, you know, between Naspers and Prosus, I mean, just a huge business that represents a massive part of our market. But the point is, if it's only half of your money in an index and the other half is, you know, paying fund managers to do something very different, then you're getting a benefit there. But that's my last comment on that, is don't choose, you know, fund managers or investment companies that are just tracking the index with slight tweaks, because you're just overpaying them. You have to pay them to be fundamentally different to the index. And then you're getting diversification. If that feels too complicated and too messy, just buy the index and know you're going to be right, you know, 80% of the time.
Absolutely. Now, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it depends on how much, you know, PT you want to put into it. But I think just a well-diversified, I mean, I have my kids' tax-free savings accounts. They're just 50% here, 50% overseas, you know. Simple, but not. I just use the feeder funds, obviously the index funds. And you know, I'm like you, Warren. I just thought the less the better. But just as a matter of interest, Berkshire Hathaway would be an example, of course, of one of the investment funds that can invest. That's probably the most one that most people are most familiar with. I was trying to rack my brain thinking of an example of one, and then of course Warren Buffett came up. But Warren, I want to say thank you so much. It was really great and insightful. I'm sure many of the listeners have found that very useful. But maybe we can just tell everyone where they can get the book. There are Global Investing Made Easy. Where can they get it? I was imagining every bookstore.
Yeah, thanks, Maya, and thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. You're right. So definitely, you know, online, you know, the big online retailers already have it. Surprisingly, they were quick off the mark. So pretty much every bookstore, it should be there by now already. And then online, you know, the Amazons and the Takealots already have it. I know it's already on Kindle. So I think people should be able to find it, you know, if they're just looking online or at their local retailer.
Excellent. So if you're wanting to invest offshore, you want to do a little bit more, look, you know, just understand it a little bit better, you can pick up Warren's latest book. And best of luck. And thanks, Warren, for sharing your expertise and insights with us today.
Thanks, Maya.